Okay, well, I'm going to introduce to you this next session, which is concentrating on microphysics of shocks, and try and give you a brief overview of the things people are interested in the case of relativistic shocks. But first of all, just to motivate it a little bit, I'll talk about the observational status of relativistic shocks with respect to observations of gamma ray bursts, and then take you through this introductory theory, talk about the issues of current interest, and finally, as a sort of pendant, a quick slide on the observational status of relativistic shocks in respect to the Crab Nebula before coming to the conclusions. So, observational status, well, you need a prediction for comparison with observation, and this is perhaps the most relevant prediction. It's a prediction of the first order Fermi acceleration mechanism operating at a relativistic shock, and I'll tell you the details of how it was made later, or well, not too many of the details. What you see here is a power law index. It's called S because this was done long before people called it P in the case of gamma ray bursts. So S, you have to subtract 2 and you get what you know as P, and it's plotted here against the essentially the relativistic Lorentz factor, the bulk Lorentz factor of the shock, but it's multiplied by the speed so that you can go down to a non-relativistic shock here as this quantity goes to zero. And you see that according to this theory, which has been called the universal power law, what happens is that if you take two different equations of state, then the predicted power law index does indeed converge as the shock becomes faster and faster, so that above a Lorentz factor of about 10 or 20, you would expect, according to this theory, a P of about 2.2, 2.23, something like that. And this is just a reflection of what happens to the hydrodynamic jump conditions in the shock, because these two equations of state, one of them is just a thermal gas, the Singe equation of state, and the other one is a relativistic gas, which is perhaps more appropriate for internal shocks if it's already going through a pre-shocked medium. They also converge on a compression ratio which is 3. So a non-relativistic shock strong would be 4. This one doesn't have its non-relativistic counterpart because it's a relativistic gas. They also converge to 3, and that's what's happening in this prediction here. So this has raised quite a bit of interest, and the first thing you can compare it with are observations of the prompt emission. So here is a collection of BATSE bursts fit with the band spectrum, I think, and the solid line here shows the histogram of the P values, and the green line shows the 2.23, which is that asymptotic spectrum at very high Lorentz factors. And you might think that's good agreement, but actually the spread in these values of P is so enormous that you couldn't possibly get it by just trying to adjust the figure I showed you on the previous page. So there's a huge spread between between 1 and 4 here, which is difficult to explain if you think the power law ought to be universal. These authors have tried to find a value of a universal power law by trying to narrow this distribution, interpreting the P value as coming from a cooled or an uncooled electron distribution at will, if you like, and managed to move some of these into a tighter distribution around here, which is not doing the theory any good because, of course, it's moving it away from the prediction, and it's, in any case, still leaves you with a substantial spread. So, unfortunately, there's no message coming from these observations which says we have discovered that this predicted power law is in fact there. And there's another way you can get at the power law of injected electrons, and that is by not measuring the spectrum, but by measuring the temporal decays. And from what we've heard in the last couple of days, you may, as I have, reached the conclusion that this is probably not the way to go, and that the temporal decays here cannot be reliably mapped into the injected electron distribution. But nevertheless, there's a lot of data, so one can present it, and In some of these models, it's stated that the alpha 2 here, at long time, if you have one index of injection for the electrons, should actually equal p, and that's the value I've put here. You see, again, there's no convincing evidence that this universal power law is present in the data. There may be one or two sources which happen to be accidentally close to it, but it's certainly not a smoking gun for the universal power law index. Okay, so how does this process work? Let's look at the very basics of a shock. These three pictures here are three trajectories of a particle which is encountering a shock front. And you can imagine that the fluid is flowing in relativistically from the left-hand side, and at this line undergoes a discontinuous deceleration and is flowing out at C over 3, basically, on the right-hand side. What I've drawn is the trajectory of a particle which is even more relativistic than the fluid. So it's an energetic particle upstream, and it's moving around because the magnetic field in this upstream shock is perpendicular to the screen here. The magnetic field, actually, in relativistic shocks has to be perpendicular to the shock normal. If you just do a Lorentz transformation, you have any field lying around in the pre-shocked medium, given by this prime here. By the time you move into a frame where the shock's at rest, the field is automatically oriented to being in the plane of the shock. So you get a gamma factor multiplying the perpendicular component. You don't get a gamma factor multiplying the parallel component. So this, although it might look like a special case, is in fact generic. Perpendicular shocks are the case when they are relativistic for large gamma. And what happens to the particle? Well, there's an E field vertically here, which is causing it to drift into the shock. That's just giving it the bulk speed of the fluid. And when it hits the shock, because of the discontinuity in B, there's a sort of grab B drift, which enables this particle to swap around field lines and take advantage of the fact that the field is pulling it up. So according to its phase, if, for example, this one hits at a very favorable point, and here's the trajectory expanded a little bit, it manages to cross the shock front three times and gains energy as a result, because moving up in the electric field in this diagram is equivalent to gaining energy. This one also gains some energy, but there are also some phases of particles which are unlucky enough to lose energy. They end up further down. They happen to hit the shock front when they're at the bottom of one of their oscillations. This is what happens if you have a large-scale ordered magnetic field. But that's not what gives you the universal spectral index. The spectral index comes about if you don't have a large-scale ordered field. And what happens then is that particles don't make these loops, but rather wander around in some kind of turbulent field, crossing and recrossing the shock front and getting a boost in energy from not from this electric field, but from more kinetic effects, kinematic effects, rather, as they do it. So if you have an ordered field and no scattering, that's no turbulence, no disordered field, then that process is not a stochastic one. You get a fixed energy gain for each particle. Depends on the phase where it hits the shock. This energy gain can be substantial. It can make the synchrotron emissivity jump by an extremely large factor of the order of gamma. There's an upper limit to the energy gain because there's only a certain phase where you can get your maximum. And there's no characteristic spectrum. What you put in, you get out. You put in a power law spectrum, it comes out. You put in a monochromatic injection function, that's almost what you get out. On the other hand, if you do have scattering, then you have this possibility of having cyclic energy gain, crossings and recrossings, and that's tied to an escape probability. Between each crossing and recrossing, the particle could indeed be dragged off downstream. The energy gain, the total energy gain here, then, is only limited by whatever loss processes are going on, synchrotron emission or perhaps collisions with the background plasma, but not by the phase at which the particles hit the shock front. So there is a limit, but it's by a different process. And it does give you a characteristic spectrum, because the competition between this cyclic energy gain and a stochastic escape probability removes the energy scale from the problem, and you get a power law distribution if you look at particles which have done that often enough. So if you wait for several crossings, then your energy in your particle greatly exceeds any of the other relevant energy scales coming in, like, for example, the energy of the electrons in a pair plasma, or the energy of the protons. This is the bulk speed of the incoming material here, gamma. If you exceed those two, then you get a characteristic power law spectrum, and that's where that so-called universal index came from. So much for the basics. Now, what are really people interested in these days? Because this power law index started off, the industry started off in about 87, and there are nevertheless some recent papers which are addressing interesting issues, and there are two. The first is it possible for a significant number of particles to get away from the thermalization process? Because having a shock front means that somehow you're taking charged particles and subjecting them to possibly short wavelength turbulence and degrading their energy, making it random. In order to get this crossing and recrossing and acceleration to extremely high energy, a certain number of these have to escape that process. And the first important question, which is unsolved also at non-relativistic shocks, is it possible to get a significant number of them to do it? And the second, which is perhaps an easier problem and therefore has attracted more interest, is suppose this works, how can you model the transport? Because the way in which they cycle the shock and the escape probability itself, they go in to determining the spectral index, which is something you might like to measure. So there are various ways of modeling that. And there are two methods one can use to attack these issues. Issue number one can really only be addressed sensibly with a particle-in-cell plasma simulation, whereas issue number two, you have a choice. You can either allow particles to scatter according to some prescription and do a Monte Carlo, or you can fix the turbulent fields and try and integrate trajectories in those fields, or you can assume some analytic description of the transport properties and therefore deduce the power law index. So what about the first issue, which is the more difficult problem and therefore is on a very dense slide full of text? There are at least five groups known to me that are currently performing large-scale 3D relativistic particling cell simulations with a view to finding out about the shock structure, which is basically behind this injection problem. And you'll hear some of them, I think, later on. This method is basically very good for studying the thermalization process. If you want to know how the particles get deflected and how the energy is randomized, then this is a very good method for that. It's not so easy to study just a few particles which are getting out of the thermalization process and going into the cyclic energy gain. And the other general comment on these simulations is that what we're interested in is trying to get some kind of steady state. I mean, if everything is changing in time, then this is going to be a difficult thing to compare with observation. But if there is somehow some steady state shock structure, that will be something one could investigate more carefully. But it's not yet been successfully found, this steady state structure. It's very difficult to initiate a shock. You end up with particles which are somehow reflected and go out of the box of simulation and all kinds of difficulties like that. However, the whole game is easier if you think you have a pair plasma, so this would not be very relevant for afterglows, perhaps, but more for the prompt emission, because the timescales you have to resolve are not so disparate. The timescale of gyration or the plasma frequencies of electrons and protons are so different that this makes it very expensive. If you just have a pair plasma, it's much easier. So these two are the conclusions which I have collected from the literature, which I think are fairly firm results of the simulations that have been done so far. And the first is that if you have a pair plasma and the plasma going in is not very strongly magnetized, a magnetization parameter of less than 0.1. The magnetization parameter is the ratio of the thermal energy, basically, to the other way around, the magnetic energy to the thermal energy, including rest mass. So this is a very could be quite a strong magnetic field, but the rest mass is still dominant. If you have a low magnetization, then the fields which are produced by the vibral instability initially can overwhelm any ordered component of that low magnetization and make the basically the ordered field unimportant. In this case, it seems possible that you could tear away particles from that kind of those loops I was showing you at the beginning, which drag them immediately off downstream and give you only shock drift or non-stochastic acceleration. So that, at least to me, is an optimistic sign from these simulations that the first order Fermi process would be possible in such a configuration, but it's not yet been seen. There could be several reasons for that. The amount of time you have to do the simulations, and especially the fact that you don't really have a steady state structure yet. The other thing which I've extracted from the PIC simulations is that at high magnetizations, that means sigma of above 0.1 roughly, these field fluctuations do not manage to disrupt the ordered component. And therefore, the stochastic transport across B in a pair plasma does appear to be strongly suppressed, which means that the first order mechanism would not work. You'll be back to a one-off shock drift acceleration or a modification of that, which somehow uses a little bit of plasma turbulence to keep the particles near the shock front. But these don't give you the characteristic power law spectrum at very high electron energies, which the first-order Fermi mechanism would give you. So that's the first issue. The second one, particle transport. How can one model the particle transport? There are, as I said, three possible approaches to that. And the first one is the analytic description. Historically, it's also the first one, where you assume that particles diffuse in pitch angle according to some rule, which could be quite anisotropic, but you have to specify it analytically. You assume it diffuses in pitch angle, and you can actually solve the problem using the eigen function expansion and very rapidly get the asymptotic power law index. And here's a plot similar to the first one I showed you, where S, take off 2 and you have P, varies with the shock speed, but this time comparing isotropic diffusion in angle of these particles with about as anisotropic as we can get it. Because after all, at a shock front, turbulence will be compressed, and you would expect the pitch angle diffusion to be anisotropic in nature. Even though the final distribution might be driven to isotropy, particles might be scattered more rapidly when they're going, let's say, shock plane than when they're going perpendicular to it. But even bending this by a factor of 10 with this analytic method, the changes which we managed to find in the predicted power law index are minute, 0.02 here, asymptotically at high. Of course, in the transrelativistic regime, there is quite a bit of action. I mean, there's moving from 4 to 4.2, but it's not enough to make that large spread in P's, which you saw in the BATSI results. The second possibility is that you don't look at an analytic description, but prescribe the way in which particles diffuse according to some Monte Carlo rule. Now, this is a little bit expensive because the charged particles don't usually have large angle collisions. They move in a helix or in some kind of trajectory which is responding to the turbulent magnetic field. They move around slowly in angle. And so to do a Monte Carlo, you have to make many small angle scatterings. So that's expensive, but nevertheless been done by a large number of people. And the results are pretty much in agreement in the sense that the value of S, which was found, here's one example by Bram Achterberg, the value of the asymptotic power law index agreed with the analytic results. And in even more detail, here's the angular distribution of particles at the shock front. That also agrees pretty well with the analytic results. But these things can do more, of course. You can put in a small ordered field component in this kind of Monte Carlo distribution and find out if that's going to affect the acceleration. And indeed, it seems that it does. A small ordered field does help drag the particles off downstream, and you lose the efficiency of acceleration. And the third possibility is to do all the stochastic work in making a single realization of a turbulent field. So you specify the magnetic field and some, let's say, Kolmogorov turbulence spectrum. You try and make sure that your charged particle is going to remain in the inertial range of this turbulence, and you just set about solving the equation of motion many, many, many times. So this is a very good user of computer time, and was first done about 10 years ago by Ballard and Heavens, the Polish group, and especially I'm going to look at some recent results by these people. What's been done here is more or less what you ought to be able to get from this if you knew what the characteristics of the turbulence were giving you. And there's been some agreement too. For example, these people, Le Moine and Peltier, found very good agreement with the analytic asymptotic power law value if they used isotropic turbulence. But there's also been some disagreement, and that's an issue I just want to comment on briefly here, with some recent simulations in which the turbulence was allowed to be compressed at the shock front, so it became very anisotropic at the shock front. And the results are that the spectral index is very much softer than had been predicted for isotropic turbulence or had been found in using the analytic methods previously. So 2.23 would have been the analytic result, but these are 2.6, and it's not clear whether this is going to be an asymptotic value, but at least it doesn't seem to be getting back down to the 2.3, which we found here. I should say that these simulations are done in a special way. It's very expensive to integrate enough trajectories to get this power law index. So what they did was to integrate many trajectories in an upstream plasma and many trajectories in a downstream plasma, and figure out the statistics of probability of return in each of those media, and then put them together, which is actually not quite legal, because it's conceivable that there are correlations between a particle which leaves one medium at one angle and enters it at a very closely related angle in the other medium. So the authors, of course, are aware of that and voice the opinion that that should average out. But who knows? I think there's more work to be done here. One especially interesting point is that these points do not appear to be returning to the non-relativistic value, which is, in fact, if this really is gamma here, would be at the origin, where diffusive shock acceleration gives you a value of 2 for this P here. So unless their simulations come down here, they would be in conflict with the standard theory of diffusive shock acceleration at supernova remnant shocks. And for me, actually, that wouldn't be so impossible, because in this kind of compressed turbulence, it's not necessarily the case that you really have spatial diffusion. There are other possibilities. You could have a sub-diffusive regime in which particles don't. The square of the distance a particle moves does not go up linearly with time. So this would mean that you had a different kind of escape probability in this turbulence, and I find it quite conceivable that the non-relativistic result in that case would be somewhat steeper here. So let me summarize these particle modeling approaches. In each of these, you can address different problems. Some of them you can look at the ordered field, in others you can't, in this one. They seem to agree, at least the first two, and the last one has provided us with this very recent hint that the compressed turbulence may be doing something different, maybe introducing anomalous transport and therefore a different kind of spectrum and steepening it. That would give us a larger spread. But before you think that the observational situation is really quite hopeless for that power law index, let me remind you of the integrated spectrum of the Crab Nebula, which is an object where many people really believe that there is a very highly relativistic flow of gamma of 10 to the 5 or possibly 10 to the 6, which is going through a termination shock before entering the nebula. And what one sees here is that over something like, well, conservatively 4 decades in frequency in the X-ray to hard X-ray regime, you have a power law spectrum which is almost certainly synchrotron radiation, which agrees very closely with that asymptotic index found from the analytic theory. So, of course, there are other pulsar wind nebulae which don't show quite the right spectral index, but then the measurements are not quite so good, there's not such a range in frequency, and there could also be different values of magnetization, which in the Crab case is thought to be quite small. That's not all you get from this relativistic shock, because there's another range. There's another range down here in which clearly some other acceleration process is operating, so in the radio to optical, much harder spectrum available. So to conclude, the analytic theory and the Monte Carlo results give you a prediction of the spectral slope for a very strong ultra-relativistic shock, provided you're looking at non-thermal particles, well above all the other characteristic energies. If you had high magnetization, that would destroy this picture. The effect of an anisotropic turbulence is, I would say at the moment now, controversial. It could change this. But you should remember that there are several effects which could produce deviant, in other words, not equal to this, deviant spectral indices, such as the fact that the shock is becoming mildly relativistic, or that the compression ratio is being changed because of the field generation, or it's being changed by pair production, or that it's somehow thermal electrons of Lorentz factor comparable to the incoming bulk flow, which are making your synchrotron spectrum. Thank you.
Questions? Matthew?
John, with the Lemoyne and Revenue results, just to clarify, you're saying that in calculating the spectral index, they're assuming that the upstream and downstream angular distributions are uncorrelated. Is that or only partially correlated?
Yes. What they compute is the conditional probability for exiting from a medium given the angle at which you enter. So there are two angles, an entrance and an exit angle, and they have a table which relates those two. Mm-hmm. In upstream and in downstream. Right. And in downstream, additionally, there's an escape probability which comes along.
Right.
Then you take these tables of the probabilities and put them together to find the power law index. Now, if it's the case that a particle, you see, the possibility of having strong correlations between the same, well, the different trajectories upstream and downstream is ignored in that case. Yeah, mm-hmm. You assume that any particle coming in at an angle is coming in at that angle, and it doesn't matter, for example, what the magnetic field was doing at the point the particle entered the downstream medium. If there is a region where the magnetic field is parallel to the shock normal and particles there are doing a lot of acceleration, then that would not appear in this picture because the magnetic field orientation is ignored. Mm-hmm. When you put those two together. So they're correlated in a sense, but the full trajectory is somehow cut. All the information is not still present when you put them together.
You're talking about how these relativistic spectral indices are unlikely to come down to the non-relativistic result. I take it that these relativistic shock indices do not depend on the shock compression ratio.
They do. At the moment, I've forgotten exactly what the prescription was for the shock compression ratio. So,
of course, the equation.
Yes, that would make a big difference.
But of course,
yes.
The non-relativistic result will depend on the.
That's true. Yes.
Yeah. So I was wondering how you transition between one case and the other.
Yeah, I think I'm correct in saying that with their shock junk conditions, you ought to go through this. But perhaps I should check that more carefully. This steepening is not just an effect of the junk conditions they use. The fact that it's asymptotically above 2.3 is certainly real.
Other questions? Yes.
I was confused a little bit by your remark regarding escaping thermalization as a prerequisite for further acceleration. And this is certainly true for relativistic shocks, but I think the opposite is maybe true for non-relativistic. If particles are thermalized, they almost by definition can be injected, at least significant fraction of these particles by just by writing Kihonian. Their thermal velocity is definitely part of this downstream distribution possess thermal velocities sufficient high enough to reach the shock and to be involved in further acceleration.
Yeah, let me just, I think in the first part of your question you switched it around. Particles certainly have to escape thermalization in non-relativistic shocks. Yeah? Okay, but you... Yeah, escaping thermalization didn't mean escaping deflection. In other words, if a particle comes into what you might like to call a relativistic shock or some region where something is starting to happen and continues for a long way without being thermalized or deflected, then it's possible that it gets so far downstream that there's no possibility of returning to the shock and undergoing these crossings and recrossings. That's certainly true. But on the other hand, it has to escape thermalization in the sense that if it's restricted to just having the same gamma factor as it had in the bulk flow coming in, then you wouldn't get a power law spectrum from that either. You get some kind of relativistic Maxwellian.
Other questions?
Okay.